Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest edition of the River Pod with myself, Tom Nash. And yes, we are going to be picking up the pieces of the defeat in the Superclásico on Sunday afternoon in Córdoba. Not a pleasant first half of the podcast. Plenty of grumbling, plenty of long faces, which you'll have seen all around Núñez on Sunday afternoon if you were here in Buenos Aires with me. But the good news is that we did get a good result on Wednesday night, switching to the Copa Libertadores. River's now 9 out of 9, very close to qualifying for the next round with a win on the road. So we have got a more upbeat second half of the podcast, or at least partially, or in comparison, much more upbeat. But the first half of the podcast is going to be full of regrets and frustrations, isn't it, Jack Tillman? Well, bring you in at this point. We finally meet again. I think we both needed Monday off after the Superclásico to sort of get over the hangover, the psychological hangover that defeat leaves. It leaves you a bit groggy, I think, a Superclásico defeat. And well, Tuesday, Wednesday, I think we just waited for the result in Paraguay, and now here we are on Thursday afternoon. So welcome to the pod, and unfortunately, we're going to have to get our hands dirty in the first half of this one, Jack.
Yeah, Tom, it's definitely a very mixed bag here on the River Pod this week. You know, I sort of felt that it was coming. We'll get into the nuts and bolts of the match, but even so, I really struggled to get over this one. I didn't look at Twitter. I didn't, read Olé or any of the, La Nación, any of the Argentine papers. I literally didn't look at anything for a couple of days after. And then finally, I guess it was Tuesday night, I got around to watching the extended highlights. Because I feel like when you watch a Superclásico, I always like to take some notes before we do our pod. And, I remember some of the key moments, but the Superclásico is kind of a blur, especially once they went 3-1 up. So I was pretty down about this one, Tom. But as you said, luckily we'll have a more upbeat second part of the pod, but it's a Superclásico. It has to be discussed. We have to put on our game faces and get through this.
Yeah, I guess let's try and work out where it went so wrong, Jack, and what it left for River on Sunday afternoon. Because I think it was one of the hardest ones we've had to take recently, because I think my reflection would be that we've lost Superclásicos over the last 6 years, but they always left behind a sort of moral victory, or at least a moral draw. I don't think you ever looked back on the game and thought, well, Boca was the better team, they really deserved it, they're a better team than us, they're moving in a better direction than we are. I think, the Superclásicos they've won over the last 6 years are largely just, they got a bit lucky, and they played like a small team. They got men behind the ball, and they managed to hit us on the break. I think the Sebastián Villa goal at El Monumental in 2022 is the best example of that. You always felt like River was the team on the front foot, playing like the biggest club in the country, and Boca was sort of running scared, really, with 11 men behind the ball for the entire match. But that dynamic is my first call out to you in the first half. When River was ahead, I called this out to you that dynamic's changed. Like Diego Martinez, hats off to him. Applaud a lot of the things he's done in recent weeks, especially over the two Superclásicos. He sort of completely reversed that dynamic of the last 5 years. That we got used to it as River fans, didn't we? I feel like we got used to Boca playing on the back foot right from the Alfaro days all the way through now up until the Almirón days last year. But we were used to being the team on the front foot, and they were sort of pinned in their own half. But Diego Martinez has changed it. Boca, they play these Superclásicos now 20 meters further up the field than they used to. Like they want to camp out in our half and have 10 men in our half and have possession, which is a complete turnaround. Because it's almost like a generation or half a generation of River fans who are just not used to that at all. I think we probably got a bit spoiled, because it's unusual for that to last that long. A sort of footballing dominance and even a moral dominance in this derby to go on for that long. That's what it was on Sunday. Sunday was the first time that we've lost to them, and I've had to really take my hat off and say, yeah, God, you're the better team. We absolutely deserve to lose. And to my memory, Jack, it's the first time they've beaten us completely from top to bottom and deserved it. And probably since 2017 was the last time I felt that they beat us and were better than us and deserved that win. Would you concur with that? That it's been quite a long time First of all, do you concur with that point that they were definitely deserved winners? And also that it feels like it's been a very long time since we actually said that after a Super Classico.
Well, Tom, I'll take the first point you made about the moral victories. I think the first Super Classico of this year in El Monumental, we were definitely the moral victors. River was pushing on the entire second half, trying to get that second goal. And there was that famous, you know, interaction between Borja and Romero, who was wasting so much time. And, you know, Borja kind of pointed at his badge saying, hey, look at the club you represent. This is, you're acting like Chacarita Juniors or something here. Get the ball and play. I don't know if they are the better team, but they definitely have a better combination of the coaching, with players believing in the coaching, and maybe top to bottom, they have a little more, what's the word I'm looking for, Tom? Maybe it's diversity in the squad. And I mean that in the sense of from goalkeeper through to the top, they have a lot of different options. Whereas we don't necessarily have that. We have a lot of guys playing in similar positions, sort of like the Lanzini, Barco, Diablito, who all sort of want to, you know, have that same sort of role on the pitch, you know, obviously give or take a little bit. Whereas Boca have, you know, some box to box midfielders. They didn't even have Medina, which we spoke about. Whereas we have some good central defenders. We have a lot of central defenders, not all of them reliable. But we don't have a lot of option at the side backs, the right and left back. And up front, we don't have really anyone besides Miguel Angel. So yeah, I think overall their squad is built a little bit better. You know, we spent all this money, spent all this time bringing in Santana, and he doesn't even play, doesn't even get on the bench a lot of the time. And so Diaz blows hot and cold. So we have a lot of guys that just are sort of treading water or sinking. So I think overall, maybe they do deserve the victory. We can get into some of the controversies in a minute, Tom. But do you agree with me that maybe Boca has less glaring holes in their squad right now than we do? And then obviously the big thing that I mentioned, that this game is won by goals. And right now, Boca has one striker in Edinson Cavani, who is a guy who's played at some of the biggest clubs in the world, like Manchester United and PSG and Napoli. And then they have Merentiel, who's a very, very useful striker at this level. And yeah, I think they have fewer holes. What do you think?
Yeah, I do. I think we're finally finding out how badly built our squad is, because I have a lot of interaction with the Uruguay football account, Uruguay Football in English, and Heroes of Uruguay accounts on Twitter, and they're obviously always looking out for the Uruguayan guys. And like, where's Boselli? Like, why is he not playing? He played well last time I watched him play for River. And I said, well, he plays at right back sometimes, and he should have been playing in this game. I think naming Herrera was a big mistake. It should have been Boselli when you've got a difficult task defensively. Boselli needs to be the man playing, because Herrera can't handle that side of the game. So why don't you play him at centre-back? I said, look, our squad is built terribly. And in summary, we've got too many centre-backs and not enough of them are reliable. Poor options for full-backs, and most of those are off form. A glut of attacking midfielders. I mean, we can't even get enough minutes in the squad to get people like Mastantuono and Lanzini and Barco and Echeverri all on the pitch at the same time. Unreliable central midfielder options. And we're clearly lacking a number nine who can come on and help, you know, take some of the burden off Borja, which, you know, that we were crying out for that on Wednesday night in Paraguay. Borja was clearly almost desperately asking to be subbed, and there's just nothing on the bench there. So, you know, our squad is just really poorly built at the moment. It's got a glut of options in some positions and a complete lack of them in others. So, yeah, I would agree with you. Bocas is built much more coherently. And they've got a clearer starting 11 as well. I think with Boca, you could pick 11 guys who are playing okay to well and build the starting 11 quite easily. Whereas River, at the moment, you look among our guys and you're almost scratching your head and thinking, well, who's worse, not who's better? You know, what's the least bad option I can put here? So, yeah, I think we're finding out that a lot of the poor work we've done assembling this squad over the last couple of years, I think a lot of it came to the fore on Sunday afternoon and just was far too exposed.
Yeah, well, Tom, should we take it back to the top? You know, we get the goal, a great run from Claudio El Diablito Echeverri, who lays it off to Borja, who has a very nice finish. And at that point, I was feeling pretty good. I was feeling really, really good. How are you feeling as we made our way through the first half? I think there is definitely another issue that's been a River Plate issue for a long time, even when we had Gallardo and everybody wants to act like, you know, the River of Gallardo was the Pep's Barcelona that won, you know, every trophy every year, when in reality that wasn't the case. But we struggled even in those days. You know, you remember that one Superclásico de Monumental, the semifinals of Libertadores. We played so well that night to beat Boca 5-6, maybe 7-0. And it ended up us begging for time in La Bombonera because we could only win by 2 goals and ended up being 2-1 aggregate and very close to Boca getting that equalizer and taking it to penalties. So, you know, I think that we needed to get that second goal and we needed to obviously keep them off the score sheet, and they're able to get a goal right before the half. But I mean, how are you? Did you think that River had it in them to get the second goal, you know, at some point in the first half? Because I certainly thought we were the better side in the first half.
Yeah, I thought it would be a sort of business as usual River Plate win at that stage, you know, a 1 or 2 nil win. It looked like we'd, after 20 minutes, it looked like it would really work out because, again, we've been spoiled, really. We've now been in the lead in 4 Superclásicos in a row. Like, we used to being ahead against Boca. We used to being the team that scored the first game. Now that's the 4th Superclásico in a row where we have scored the first goal. So I think, you know, we're pretty much settled in that dynamic where we win this game quite often now. But yeah, I was happy after 20 minutes. But as that half wore on, I think there were more and more warning signs because Boca were getting a lot of balls into our box. You know, we were winning the headers and Cavani was getting flagged offside. But especially from their left side, from our right side, which, you know, people are targeting that now because they know Herrera is the weak link in our defence. I just didn't like the fact that we couldn't seem to get a foothold in midfield. You know, their midfield was able to receive, turn and pass in a forward direction, whereas our midfielders were just not getting the time and space to do that. So I think that's where Boca began to turn the match in their favour from sort of 25 and 30 minutes onwards. But the amount, I say, even when River was ahead, I'm saying this isn't sustainable. The amount of crosses they are able to land into our box. I mean, you can look at fullbacks. You can also look at the fact that they're not getting support from further ahead of them in the midfield, because sometimes it takes, you know, 2 guys to stop a cross coming into the box. You need the midfielder to take care of their midfielder, and your fullback can take care of their attacker. But we didn't get that. So, you know, when the half went on and they equalised, I think at halftime, I think that was a fair result to go in with, because, you know, we had chances and we were lethal with that break that Echeverri led and Borja scores. But, you know, the writing was sort of on the wall because it was unsustainable to be that exposed at the back, I felt.
Certainly. And I also sometimes get the impression that, I don't get the impression, I see it clearly, that River a lot of times isn't as good as playing to Borja's strengths as Boca is to playing Cavani's and Merentiel's strengths. And obviously, even last year, which Boca made a farcical run to the Libertadores final, winning all of their rounds on penalties, you know, barely not winning a match, barely scoring goals. But Cavani was still getting great chances. He was just missing them. And you know, a player of his quality, even at his age, is eventually going to start scoring them. You know, I did not, we had a laugh about it, but in all honesty, I did not see Cavani's spell at Boca ever turning into a De Rossi type situation where he was sort of here on holiday for 6 months and was like, you know what, I'm gonna piss off back to Italy. I always thought, unfortunately, that Cavani was going to come good, and it's very unfortunate. I thought we were let off the hook a little bit in the Monumental when he took off Cavani, because personally, a player with that quality and the killer instincts in the box, I mean, a guy that has won World Cup matches. I remember the game against Portugal almost single-handedly. That was in Russia 2018. And, I would never take him off the field, even if he's having a bad day, because you always think that he has one, he's going to score one maybe. So yeah, it was very disappointing to let in that goal at the end of the first half. Definitely the worst time, they always say this, to let up a goal is right before the half. And then, you know, the second half, Tom, is when we do get, in my opinion, some controversy and also some very questionable substitutions from Demichelis, which is obviously always going to be a talking point. But, you know, the elephant in the room here is the goal that Carambola, you know, the ball that rebounds and you know, is given as a goal on the field. And, you know, this is not the Premier League. There's no goal line technology or Hawkeye, you know, that you have in the tennis where you just know automatically, no arguments can really be made whether the ball crossed the line. And this took forever to get a decision. I mean, what did you make of this goal line decision personally? And I'm not going to let this say that, well, River deserved to win because of the goal was disallowed, because we were very poor the entire second half. But did you, what, I mean, what did you make of it? What do you make of the way that it's done in Argentina? And did you think it was a goal? Did you think it crossed the line? And or do you think it was inconclusive? And the fact that it was given as a goal on the field means that it should have stayed? Because that's technically what VAR is supposed to do. If it's not conclusive, VAR is not supposed to then overturn what the referee has said was his decision on the pitch.
Yeah, I think it's an incredibly subjective one as well, because I didn't find the killer angle. We didn't, you know, a lot of times these things happen and you see the killer angle on some camera captures it and it's clear what the answer is. But I never found throughout the course of Sunday that really happened. The photos taken from outside the goal line makes you think, well, that's crossed. And then from inside the goal makes you think, no, he might have actually stopped that while some of the ball is still in contact with some of the line. So I never really drew a conclusion. But yeah, I guess your logic is a lot of people, River fans, are questioning what you said there, Jack. If it's to correct a clear and obvious mistake, whereas this is completely subjective. How can we tell? I don't think it's actually possible from the angles that we were seeing to know for sure if it went in or not. So in that case, the goal should stand. So yeah, there were two things annoyed me after the game, though. One, the lack of goal line technology. I mean, I barely ever watch a tennis match, even less now. I live in Argentina, not England, but they've been using Hawkeye for 20 years. I mean, it's not that difficult, guys. Like, they can, every single marginal call at Wimbledon, they've got it there with it on a camera within 5 seconds. And how are we in this situation? This is a black and white issue because penalties are subjective. Did he contact him before, inside or outside the area? Is it enough contact? All that stuff we're going to argue about until we die because it's subjective. But really, you know, whether one object is to the east of another one or not is a black and white subject. And so I was very angry that we're still not using this. They're actually ironically now talking of implementing it, of course. So that was the one thing that annoyed me, just how badly this has been organized. The second one is something that you've alluded to there, actually, Jack. I just think that there were River fans that spent their entire evening on Sunday talking about this decision, whereas I think you're distracting attention from where it needs to be, because Boca was the better team for these 90 minutes. And if you're reliant on that call, which again is marginal and subjective, if it had gone half a meter over the line, a sort of Lampard style in South Africa, I would agree. I'd be very angry with them. But you're relying on something that's easily open to interpretation when we were not the better side. So I think it's worth calling out, but I don't think it's worth deflecting attention from the fact that Boca completely overrun us in that second half.
Yeah, and one thing I think that's a little bit different, you know, that you mentioned the Lampard goal in that situation. That was also a really nice take by Lampard. You know, he volleys it in from outside the box. It hits the bar, clearly goes in, and it was the Uruguayan ref. I'm forgetting his name right now, that doesn't give the goal. This was a goal that was sort of a fluke goal. It wasn't like some moment of brilliance from River that the referee took from us. As I try to be as subjective as I can here, 4 days after the match, it was, you know, it was the ball was bouncing around and it almost ended up perhaps in the goal But it wasn't some moment of brilliance that the referee then snatched from us. If it had gone in, we would have said, what a joke. Qué desastre que es Boca. You know, what a disaster is Boca that they let that kind of goal goes in. So that I think that's another thing that should be mentioned in this whole discussion. It doesn't mean that those goals all count, but it was almost like we were given a gift, not something that we had really earned. At least that's the way that I'm trying to tell myself to not get so mad 4 days after the fact.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, Boca could consider, if that had been given as a goal, which was easily could have happened as well, I mean, Boca could consider themselves very unlucky because it was just a pure luck, you know? It's a pure deflect, one of those goals that you only score once or twice a season that's based almost entirely on luck and barely any skill. So, yeah, I think they could have felt quite hard done by, not by the refereeing decision itself, but just by, in terms of footballing justice, it would have been hard for them to accept the fact they were behind, I think.
Yeah, and then, Tom, if I may, you know, moving on from this decision, because we could go on about it for the entire pod, and nobody wants to hear that. But what really sort of drove me up a wall is then a couple minutes later, the substitutions. I think Lanzini for Fernandez, Nacho Fernandez, was one that we all wanted to see. But again, Barco for Echeverri, which seems to be a substitution that Demichelis, for whatever reason, likes. I don't understand that one. It had only been 15 minutes into the second half, and I thought Diablito was by far our most dangerous player on the field in the first half. And you know, if you want to make that change, maybe make it late a little bit later on, but to bring in a like for like, more or less, Barco is never going to give you the same sort of productivity that Diablito is going to give you. That's my opinion. And I was, when I saw that substitution come up, I just threw my hands up and said, what are you doing? Why are you taking off your best player 60 minutes into the game? You know, you said that he might have had a knock. Well, he played in the starting lineup 3 days later in Paraguay. So if he had a knock, it obviously wasn't too serious. So that really, really bothered me, because it's not the first time he's made that change.
This is a bit of shrouded in mystery to me, actually, Jack, because one of the commentators, one of the touchline correspondents during the game, actually said, yeah, he's off. He's holding his calf, and he's talking to the physio while pointing at his calf and having this conversation. So it was like, we think he's injured, but I don't think this was actually clarified in the press conference. Well. And then Demichelis as well, like, he needs to get better at communication, because millions of us around the country want to know what happened there, if it was forced on Demichelis or if it was something that he actually just chose to do. And that's really important as well, because like you say, there was no reason to take Echeverri out, and especially bringing on someone who's so hopelessly out of form as Barco is. And, you know, Demichelis' press conference, this is for another day, we can go deeper on this, but his press conferences have become a bit of a farce, really. He just doesn't answer the questions that he's asked, and he makes some weird statements when he's, you know, we're lacking very clear and very essential ones like this. So, yeah, that's something that needs to definitely be improved, if his relationship with the fans is to get a bit better, I think, because it's very cold at the moment. But yeah, I agree with you. As soon as I saw, but I mean, we could write a whole book on this, though, Demichelis and second half changes, because I'm absolutely sick of seeing those five changes. I mean, we end the game with a completely different team to what we started out with, whether we're winning, losing, or drawing. It seems to be worse when we're drawing as well. And it's just, I just don't get it. I don't think the players understand. They're all in new positions, surrounded by new teammates in those positions for the first time. And I've no idea why he thinks it works in his head, because we just lose control of games completely when he starts rolling these changes. We looked not so great with our first 11, but we look at least, you know, more coherent than what we do with these five changes going on. So I'm the same as you, Jack. I just started rolling my eyes when he started making these changes, because it was obvious that we were going to start to disintegrate at that stage.
Yeah, it was definitely a snowball effect, Tom. It just kept getting worse and worse and worse. It was the goal being disallowed by VAR terrible substitution, taking your best player off, you know, for those that remember, it's like the 06 World Cup when Pekerman takes off Riquelme and brings on Cambiasso and leaves Messi on the bench, and then everything just goes to complete hell after that. This is, you know, what, 2 minutes later, 3 minutes later? I'm not blaming the goal, of course, on Barco or the substitution, but then the goal comes, and then Merentiel gets his second, and then, I mean, then it was over.
I mean, they, Jack, I think they were the worst 20 minutes I've seen. They were the most painful 20 minutes of Super Classico viewing that I've had since, I think, 2016. I think that game where they turned it around in the Monumental. Gives away the second goal, and then Tevez smashes one into our top corner, and then Centurion scores the final one on the break. I think that the end of that game was, it's probably been since 2016. For me,
yeah,
the Super Classico was as painful to watch.
This game reminded me a lot of that time. That game was a little different because Boca had gone ahead, but then Drussi and Alario score, and River has the lead going into the break. And then, so it's slightly different, but the momentum that Boca picked up sort of out of nowhere for 20, 30 minutes really reminded me of that game in 2016. I think you hit the nail right on the head there. It was so much like that, because that also is the last time that I was really down and out about a Super Clásico. You know, if you lose a game at home, you know, in La Bombonera, there's really no disgrace in that, especially with the success we've had there at times over the years. You know, we lose on penalties with a fifth choice goalkeeper who had never played professionally before because of COVID and all the changes. You don't really have anything to hang your head about. But this one, yeah, you're right, Tom. It was tough because Boca went from strength to strength. Once they got the second and the third, you thought maybe there could have been a fourth coming.
Yeah, I fully expected that 4-1, yeah. I
really did. Thankfully there wasn't, because then you start opening yourself up to even more you know, laughing from the Boca fans. So yeah, it was tough. It was very a tough second half, and you know, it was bad. And I think the manager has to answer for this. I've been trying to defend Demichelis on this podcast because I think he's been getting a lot of unnecessary flack about certain things, but at times you have to say, you know what? He got everything wrong in this one. And Herrera, you know, we've mentioned him a couple of times on here. He is very much at fault for the second goal. He was very poor all night. He's not ready to take on some players at this level. And also Enzo Diaz struggled too against Advíncula, who, you know, is a Peruvian international. I thought Aliendro was poor. You know, Eki Fernandez was very involved. Zenon is an interesting player. And all of our guys just sort of, our midfield sort of disappeared. And our laterales, our side backs, just did what they had been doing all game. But luckily we had been having enough of the ball to disguise their huge weaknesses. So, yeah, very disappointing. I lay a lot at the feet of the manager, but we also have to blame some of the players as well, because, you know, they are the ones that are on the field at the end of the day, and that some certain guys need to step it up and need to start, you know. But at the same time, you could say, well, is Nacho Fernandez finished? You know, when was the last time he put in a good performance? And then you say, well, was it his fault that he's not playing well, or is it the manager's fault that he keeps putting him in the lineup even though his performances have been leaving a lot to be desired? It's that question. So I think it's a combination, but a lot of it has to be laid at the manager's doorstep here.
Talking about the manager, Jack, I think let's open up a section. I think it's time to christen a new section of the podcast, the Demichelis thermometer, because I think, you know, on Sunday night, I think there were a large number of people who held up their hand and said, I am ready for a change of manager. And not just people who've been bitching about every little thing. A lot of people said, I'm ready for a change of manager. I think it all moved us all a little bit closer in that direction. Even the defenders of him were probably more ready for a change. So I don't know. I think it's probably good now that his job is, you know, I describe it as safe in the short term, but not in the medium term. I don't think it's safe for 3 or 6 more months. I think it's safe for this week. There's not going to be a press conference next week. If we, you know, say we lose our next match in Uruguay, I don't think he gets sacked the next day, but I think he's moving in the direction of his job being in question now. So, you know, I think we can have this section where you give your interpretation of how close he is or not to the exit door. My interpretation is that he's not immediately there now. He's still got chances to turn this around, because I don't think the Copa de la Liga is important enough to fire a manager over. It's not the main objective of the season. It's not the second main objective either. So I don't think you can fire him based on Copa de la Liga being a failure. And I don't think you can fire him based on his Superclásico record, because he's still 2-1 up in Superclásicos as well. So he's ahead in Superclásico. So basically I'm saying, if they're going to fire him, it's probably because the league or the Copa goes badly. So he lives to fight another day. You know, if he starts to go badly in the Copa or in the start of the league campaign, I think that moves him closer to the exit door. But I think for now, he's at least safe in the short term for the coming weeks. How do you feel about this? How close do you feel he is or isn't to the exit door and a change of manager coming around?
Well, Tom, this is precisely why on the last pod I said I didn't want to have a Superclásico, because of all the toxicity and the hysteria that surrounds this match. If you lose it, if Martinez had lost it, the Boca fans would have been calling for his head. And now, because Demichelis has had this, despite winning a league title, this resistance from the River fans to accept him, it now has made it a lot worse. He definitely lives to fight on another day. But if the Libertadores goes pear-shaped, or you know, the league gets off to a tough start, there's going to be more calls for his head. And also at some point, Demichelis himself is probably just going to want to leave. You know, why is he putting himself through this? You know, the guy's a very rich man. He played almost all of his career for some of the richest clubs in the world, like Malaga when they had the foreign ownership, and Man City, and obviously everything he did at Bayern Munich. So at some point, I think he might be off, and he might say, you know what, I won a couple trophies. But, you know, I know he said that you complete your contracts and all this stuff. But, you know, I definitely think he's a lot closer than he was. And he needs to win. He probably needs to win the Copa Libertadores, I think, to continue. Or it's just we're going to, you know, the other obstacle here, though, Tom, is where do you go from here? And River is a very different club than Boca. Boca has no problem bringing in a guy like Diego Martinez from Huracan, whereas, you know, where he has absolutely no connection to Boca whatsoever. You know, you look at his playing career, you know, was not impressive. His managerial career wasn't really that impressive either. And I don't necessarily want River to go down the road and get someone who I find to be kind of uninteresting and bland and never succeeded too much. But we, you know, other than Angel Capa, who was obviously a disaster and played a big part in our relegation, when was the last time, other than Capa, that River had a manager who never played for the club or wasn't de la casa, you know, from the house? And that makes it very difficult, because is Hernan Crespo any better? Or some of the other names that are bouncing around, because you're not going to bring in, you know, if the fans are having a tough time accepting Demichelis, who played for River, won a couple trophies, league titles as a player, and obviously there's some animosity because he never came back, but always said he was a River fan, never denied that. He always was outspoken that he was a fan. If they aren't accepting him, then how would the fans ever accept someone like a Diego Martinez type? And I just say somebody like him, someone who's not from the house. So because it's River, you have to bring in someone, most likely, who's de la casa. And there are not that many options out there right now. So I'm very worried about where the club goes from here.
Yeah, I think you have to be prepared for where this could lead in the next couple of months. So I think if they've done the due diligence, I think Francesco Lee will have called Ponzi up to his office on Monday afternoon and said, look, bring your coffee with you. Bring your two sugars and your ubiquitous little plastic stirrer, and we're going to talk plan B in case we need to go down that line. So I think what I would do if I was them is I'd start building up in my mind a shortlist. This is obviously not something you do in public. In public, you back Demichelis with him, but in private, you're managing a huge institution. You have to be ready for every scenario. I would start building up a shortlist, and I would work out who should go on that shortlist. I would reach out to the people closest to Hernan Crespo and say, look, if there's an opening in June or July, should we put you on the shortlist, or are you happy where you are with your job, blah, 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 and Crespo goes on or not. And the same applies to Gajardo, to Ramon Diaz, to Cudet, to Aymar as well. He's a guy who's been mentioned in the past. Like, I think we're at that stage. I think they should at least be doing their preliminary research in case we don't win any of our first three games, four games in the league, and all of a sudden you're 9 points behind Boca while the league's only just started. The league championships escaped us. Maybe that's a situation where you say, okay, plan A is still for Demichelis to turn this around, win the league, lift the Copa Libertadores gloriously at Monumental in November. Happy days. We'll all write a book about it. But you need to be ready for plan B as well, I think, at this stage, because those dark clouds on the horizon, they just moved a little bit closer in our direction, I think, on Sunday night. They're not here yet, but you should take an umbrella out with you because there are some dark clouds on the horizon. That would be my summary of it.
Certainly. I agree 100%, Tom, with what you said. And, Codet is definitely an option, but, he's at Internacional. He's probably getting paid a lot. Another name that I would inquire about, is crazy as it sounds, is what about Matias Almeida? Mm-hmm. He's in Greece, which I don't think he would be getting paid an unreasonable amount there. He handled River in the cauldron that was the Nacional B. Just another name, because as I said, it really needs to be someone who knows the club at River. One of the things I love about the club, but it certainly makes your managerial pool a lot smaller than a club like Boca, who can bring, they've obviously had the Barros Esqueloto and Arrobarena and these sort of guys that played there and everything. And obviously River doesn't really like to go down that route. So we'll just have to see. But for now, I definitely think Demichelis will continue until he's knocked out of the Copa, and then, which unfortunately seems sort of inevitable. And then we'll see what happens after that. Tom, one thing I just wanted to mention about Demichelis and this whole resistance of the fans to being able to warm up to him. Matias Almeida, who I mentioned, somewhat in jest, I was just sort of thinking of managers, but when he came back to River in 2009, he had chosen to go to play at Lyn in Norway, and a team in the Nacional Primera B Metropolitana, Phoenix, before going back to River, and the fans embraced him. And I remember a game that I attended back in 2010 when I was down there on vacation, where the fans were saying, para el pelado, la selección, for Almeida, the national team. And this was on a team that was going down to Nacional B. So it is very interesting about Demichelis, why the fans seem to hate him so much. And I think some of the vitriol he doesn't deserve, but obviously, as we said, he's definitely getting closer.
So in happier news, Jack, we had a game 3 days later, which we really needed, to be honest with you. I really needed something else to think about other than that Boca game. Even if it was another defeat, I needed something else to think about that moves your mind on from the Superclásico. We got the tonic we needed just about on Wednesday night, because we went to Paraguay. We won 2-1 against a difficult opponent. Tricky pitch as well, up at the Defensores del Chaco, the National Stadium in Asunción. And Franco Mastantuono became the youngest goal scorer in the history of River Plate in the Copa Libertadores. What an achievement for the lad, 16 years of age. But it doesn't really tell half the story, does it, Jack? Because I think, you know, on Wednesday night, I think it was definitely a game of two halves. I think the first half, River were dominant. We were pressing very well. We were recovering the ball in their half, launching attacks. You know, Libertad, and they didn't really know which direction the next attack was coming from. Solari was very active, as was Aliendro. The fullbacks were getting crosses in as well. Herrera showed his better side, getting involved in attacks near the opposition box. We got 1-0 up, you know, but we could have had more goals, really. I think if we'd been calmer, made better decisions in the final third, we could have gone in at half-time 2 or 3-0 ahead. But we didn't. We get pegged back by a dead ball and we go in at half-time 1-1, which, you know, we can get to the second half in a second, everything that was wrong with that. But were you as encouraged by that first half as I was, Jack? Because for about 35 minutes there, I was actually quite impressed for the first time in a few weeks then.
Yeah, you know, we have a goal that's ruled out with VAR. He was offside. Maybe Borja was a little bit lazy there, not getting, you know, even though it's marginal, you think maybe a striker of his experience could do a better job staying onside. A couple other decent chances, you know, Solari is also offside when he hits the bar from Borja, cross come shot that he flicks on and it hits the bar. He was probably offside, as I said. I was impressed, but then when they get the goal, it seems like it could have been Boca all over again. When you let in that goal right before the break, after you've been the better side, and that's sort of, like I said, a big problem with this team is not getting that second goal fast enough and allowing the other team back in the game. And that is something that's really plagued us, as I said, since the Gallardo years. And just allowing untimely goals before the break when you have a lead, and that gives the home team all the momentum going into half. It gets the crowd more into the match. You know, there was obviously a lot of changes not wholesale, but Herrera still starts the match. And he's a decent, you know, attacking fullback. Decent for this level. I always like to call him like a cheap version of Cafu or Dani Alves or something. But, you know, his defensive ability is very poor. I don't know why Barco started this game, what he did to get into the lineup. So I was encouraged, but all the encouragement I got was thrown out the window when they score from the set piece.
I think there are three factors in this, because we've seen this so many times this year, haven't we? We've seen a decent first half. This happened on Sunday against Boca as well. An okay to decent first half, and then a really alarmingly bad second half. You know, the amount of games, I'd called out games which we'd let lead slip in the last podcast, but we've now got two more because we let a lead slip to Boca, we've let a lead slip to Libertad. I think from looking across Twitter last night and listening to the journalists, I think there are three factors which are potentially causing this just difference between for early match and later match performances. So first one is fitness. I think the fact that we didn't get our pre-season right is maybe coming back to bite us. I think the players are ready for a break now as we get towards the middle of the year. I think they're ready for that. They've now got a two-week break till the next match as well. I think there's a lot of tiredness and a lot of regrets about the pre-season. I think there's an emotional factor. I think once we get pulled back, we can't return to the type of football we were then playing before that goal. You know, goals change games, as they say. And the third one is Demichelis meddling in the team. And every time he makes five substitutions, things tend to get worse, not better. So all of those factors are coming together in the second half of games. And we're pretty much asking for time every time we play now, aren't we? Every time whether we're ahead or drawing or even losing like we were with Boca, you're just ready for the game to end after 80 minutes because you fear what the last 10 minutes hold. So there's so much to work on there over the coming months. And, you know, I don't know if they'll get to even do a sort of pre-season as the Copa America is played, but there just seems to be multiple issues there, as well as the transfer window, which need to be addressed for the second half of the year.
Yeah, Tom, you're 100% right. And that's the manager. You know, we talk about the snowball effect against Boca, and here, you know, we ended up getting the winner, Mastantuono. Great moment. I'll give you a lot of credit, Tom, because you had been talking to me on WhatsApp saying, you know, we have to talk about this guy. He was the revelation of the early part of the tournament and then disappeared. And he comes back, though, and shows that the manager was probably wrong for completely excluding him. I don't think he should be in the starting lineup every match, but he has to be an option off the bench. He's proven that again in a hostile atmosphere in the Copa. So, yeah, the manager is the one that sets the tone. He helps set the mentality of the team. And maybe another thing there, just to briefly mention, Tom, is the on-field leadership. Where is that coming from? Obviously, Enzo Perez, we know that he left in terms of what he was doing as a number five and how much ground he could cover at this stage in his career, 36, coming on 37. You know, certainly not the same player that he was, but he had that on-field presence, that on-field leadership. You know, now the captain of the team is the goalkeeper. I never like that too much. You know, Paulo Díaz is a little bit of a leader, but in the midfield, there's not that guy that's going to grab the game by the scruff of his neck. And I know that sounds like a very Sky Sports, English Premier League type things to say, but I do honestly believe in that, because when you have someone, a rock in your midfield, you don't see this sort of periods of the match where your midfield is almost non-existent. And we're going through that quite a bit at the moment.
It's almost like we forgot how difficult the transition away from De La Cruz and Enzo Perez was, isn't it? We all knew that in December.
That's another one, Tom. I forgot to even mention him. I almost forgot about him entirely. It feels like it's been so long since he left, but what a player we lost. You know, and talk about the goals that he scored at crucial moments in winning that league title. You know, free kicks, but also driving into the box, doing sort of what Echeverri does, but he was scoring more goals, providing more assists, and controlling the game. And he was running back and tackling when he needed to as well. So that's another player that we really miss. His leadership and obviously his goals from the midfield are irreplaceable.
Okay, Jack. So we're going to have to leave it there. Park that where it is. At least we can end on a happy note. River Plate 9 points out of 9 in the Libertadores. Very close to qualification now for the next round, even if there's probably more questions than answers at the moment from this team. 2 week break, both for the River Pod and the River team. The next match is away in Uruguay, probably the one that you and I are most looking forward to in the group stage, Jack. We're away to Nacional on, I think that's on the 7th of May. So we've got a 2 week break and we can potentially even qualify for the last 16 that night. So we'll be back to talk Nacional in a couple of weeks. Thank you, Jack.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. And Libertadores is growing well. We're not thrilled with the performances, but we're on the verge of qualification and winning this group, which is obviously very key.
Yeah, absolutely are. So amen to that. Thank you all for listening again, and we will see you next time on the River Pod. Goodbye. Se viene Martínez para el gol, y va el tercero, y va el tercero, y va el tercero, y gol de River, gol de River.